extra time.
That's good to see. Yeah, this should be interesting.
Yeah.
We're on. This is public, so.
Thank you very much.
See, I may have to slip out for.
That's fine. That's fine. Excuse me? Oh, yeah, everybody's a voting member.
It's getting better, right?
Welcome, everyone. We'll open the meeting. Second meeting this year of the Pension Committee for Sussex County. And I do want to introduce one of our newest members, Hugh Leahy from Delaware Community Foundation. He could not attend last month we were here.
Yes.
Which was a tough meeting to get scheduled because we tried to get it in real quickly and getting everyone's schedules.
Lights are on in the building?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's on the internet.
This is a public meeting. We have special guests today. Public meeting, and anyone can come. It's open to the public, and it's broadcast on the internet, so just so that we know that. But anyway, one of the goals was to have the quarterly meetings throughout the year to monitor the pension accounts and see what kind of changes we may want to do throughout the year. So this is the second meeting. The other two are scheduled. And that will happen every January. I'll try to get the dates out so that we can get it on our calendar. And seven people schedule, it's a lot to work out. So today we have a presentation by Wilmington Trust Company. They're going to start. To back up the minutes, if everybody got the minutes and they can see what was taken to council from our last meeting, which was a rebalancing of the portfolio, and that was done. And Wilmington Trust Company, who has held investments for us for a long time, and I've worked with Dominic, and you can introduce your group when you come up if you'd like, have been wanting to present to us and come talk to the committee. And we had been kind of like in a state of flux until these OPEB investments got set, you know, where they belong. So it was one of the first goals for me this year was to have them speak to the committee. And then Pierce Park Group, Mr. Schoen's here for our quarterly performance reports, and then we'll go right into the speaking about the OPEB investments of any changes we want to make. Any questions or comments by the committee before we start? Okay. Dominic, if you'd like to start.
Sure thing. Foremost, I want to thank everyone for your time. And myself, Dominic Tremo, I lead the Institutional Fixed Income Group for the Wilmington Trust Company, and with me today is Nick Adams and Bethany Taylor in the client development arena. Before you, I've handed out the presentation. I welcome any questions you have. I'd like to make this as interactive as possible. First page, if you open the presentation, is just our quarterly review, and I'll leave that for your time to read. But if we turn just beyond that, I've captured the change in yield curve from quarter end over the quarter end period, and if we look at the economic activity of the first quarter, one could describe the domestic activity as a bit better, emphasis on a bit better. We began to see employment levels increase north of the 200,000 mark on a per month basis. That was seen in December, January, and February. We began to see strong manufacturing growth among all the major regions, whether it was the Northeast area, Mid-Atlantic, the West Coast, and so forth. All of that led to, you know, just an overall better tone to the economy. That was then evident within the equity market and then also within the credit spreads, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Within the Treasury market, what we see here is we began to see a bit of a steepening of the yield curve. And if we focus further out on the yield curve, 10s and 30s, we can see that they were up about 33 to 40-odd basis points for the period. The Federal Reserve through this time continued with their Operation Twist. Operation Twist was enacted last fall and will conclude this June 30th. And exactly what that is they are looking to sell securities, Treasury securities, in the shorter end of the yield curve, reposition them further out on the yield curve, keeping the long end of the yield curve relatively flat or low so that the housing market and other economic activity could continue to be stimulated. turning the page, when we look at exactly what has transpired through the quarter with respect to unemployment, we can see that we were growing in that area of 200,000, which basically gave consumers a little more confidence to go out and spend. When we look at the March number came in at 120,000, so it was a bit disappointing, being that we were seeing numbers north of 200,000. This coming Friday, or tomorrow rather, we will have the next employment number, and all eyes will be focused on that to see if the March number was more an indication that we're, you know, stepping down a gear, or are we going to continue, you know, upwards of the north 200,000. The second portion of the page, we see that unemployment has dropped now to 8.2%. We had been high as 10%. Unemployment level, the number itself, can be very misleading. For those individuals who are discouraged and are no longer considered part of the survey, they are not included in this. So it is a great headline number on the evening news on a Friday, but nonetheless, it doesn't necessarily reflect the current state of the economy. Following page, I've highlighted also the volatility index, or the VIX index, as you hear. And what we see here are there are a number of spikes that have transpired. The very large spike early on in the 2008 period was the financial crisis. And as you move forward, we see two additional spikes. Those spikes were really born out of the situation in the EU. And today, the EU situation continues to be a real issue. During the quarter, we had the restructuring of Greek debt. That restructuring, or that technical default, did put things on a back burner, or seemed to have addressed some issues, but by no means is it completely resolved. Spain is an issue before us, and that is something that we watch very closely. As you look at Spain, and the concern is that they are a very large issuer of sovereign debt. If that sovereign debt has to be restructured, it has implications to the banking sector, the European banking sector, and potentially implications to the domestic banking sector. But as volatility declined, that also has a positive influence to the corporate sector. So if we turn the page, I've captured the credit index of the Barclays, that's the Barclays credit index. And it is a bit of a busy graph, so I'll walk through it a bit. But this index itself includes all investment grade corporates, 1 to 30 year, 250 million or more outstanding. And if we look at the far right, the top line or the green line itself, that is the index spread itself. So during the quarter, we contracted roughly about 60 basis points. So as spreads contract, we get positive performance in the corporate market. The blue line it's below that is the actual yield of the index. So we concluded the period with an all-in yield of the index at a 3.29. Point of the matter here is if you were to move back in time from the green line, we see that we have had those spread levels in previous periods. But if we were to examine the lower line or the blue line and you look back in time, we are at a historical low in absolute yields. So it is still a very challenging environment with respect to yields, regardless of which sector you're in. So I'll stop there for a moment to see if you have any questions regarding the economy or. Okay. Turning over to tab one, foremost examining the pension plan. As of quarter end, we were 83% in Treasury notes, 16% in corporate notes, small amount money funds with a duration of 3.59 years, principal balance of 8.9 million, yield of 92 basis points. That's the yield to maturity at market. And below, we just capture some short-term levels. One item that I'd make note of is the three-month T-bill or the 91-day T-bill. We concluded the quarter at 7 basis points. The previous or the year end, we were at 1 basis point. And it's not so much the delta that I'd focus on, you know, albeit 6 basis points. But if we take the same three-month T-bill and we go back to November, late October, the bill itself was actually trading in negative territory. So what we see here is an economy that is improving in terms of health, and the fact that we've migrated away from that negative territory to positive territory does indicate that we have a greater confidence in the system, albeit that that confidence is somewhat weak in nature. Following page, we have the absolute performance for the pension plan. I've captured from fourth quarter of 2010 to date. Fourth quarter and 10 is when we installed or initiated the new investment policy. working with the county, working with Pierce Park Group. And what we see here for fourth quarter, we were negative 152 relative to the index, and this is the fourth quarter of 2010, relative to the benchmark of minus 155. Year-to-date in 2011, we were 587 versus the benchmark of 608. And then the first quarter of 12, minus 22 versus the index of minus 38. Annualized over this period, we matched the benchmark of 2.67 percent relative to the benchmark also of 2.67. Following page beyond that, we have the individual holdings. Again, predominantly weighted towards treasuries. Corporate positions are of high quality. We have a maximum allocation of 25% within the policy. Currently it's 16, and we'll migrate, you know, a little bit closer to that as we feel that there are some opportunities. Turning beyond the holdings, we also have the OPEB account that was initially funded this quarter. The portfolio itself is 43% in treasury notes, 29% in agencies, and as of quarter end, we were 28% in the money market fund, still deploying the assets that we received. Average duration of 3.55 years. Market value, $8.9 million. Yield is 68 basis points. Again, capturing some short-term levels below. And beyond that, we have the individual holdings of the portfolio. The performance is of a single month, so I've not captured it within this presentation. I am. I'm open to any questions you have.
These returns are depressing. What should we within policy, what should you within policy be doing differently? I mean, this is it's lucky that you came out where the benchmark was overall, but I was hoping we could outperform a little bit. Is there something within policy that you're going to recommend?
Well, I would say that, you know, when we look at the absolute rate of return, okay, of 2.67%, keep in mind that the 10-year Treasury note today trades at a 190. So yields in themselves along the curve and within various sectors are extremely depressed. So the question really that is always before us is the degree of risk that one's willing to assume, and then what is the outcome, you know, relative to that risk. The history of our relationship has been one where it's been a very, very conservative approach, much more of a laddered portfolio to meet the obligations of the county. Recently is, you know, where we began to incorporate some corporates to add additional income and yield to the portfolio. So when we look at the absolute level of yield, I know 2.67% seems low, and it is low as what we historically believe is or feel comfortable with. But in this environment, I look at it as, really a small victory relative to, what is available in the marketplace.
And I apologize, you just slapped me if I go too far, but because I'm the new kid on the block, I'm not really sure I understand the risk profiles that you've been given to work with them. But my question was,
go ahead, and maybe I can.
My question is there something within the mandate of our policy? You guys have been doing this for a long time, and given your analysis of the economy and where it's going, is there something that you could be doing that would work within, our risk profile? Is there something else you could be doing? That is a depressing yield at 2.67. I would hope that we could outperform a little bit with one of the best investment companies in the United States sitting in front of us.
Well, I appreciate the compliment there, but we would have to really open it up to allow a greater degree of corporates within the policy. We're at 25%.
What about something in the middle? What about municipal debt, other something that would be outside of corporate but not in between the treasuries and the
within the municipal area, the credit issues are there just as well. from an absolute return. It's pretty much what would be advertised here. So it is the degree to which we are invested in treasuries today. And anytime you move away from treasuries, you're incurring some level of risk. And the question before you is, are you being compensated fairly? If we look back at the credit index that was illustrated, we can see that even within the credit space today, it is fairly low in terms of absolute yield.
To follow up on what Susie said, though, and I understand there are issues with municipality credit issues throughout the country, but there are also a lot of general obligation.
Right, taxing.
Municipals that really are returning a much better yield than treasury. Do you have an aversion overall to municipals as a category?
I do not. So if that's something that we could, or is open for exploration, be happy to do that, be happy to support and provide any market data that you may need to make that decision. But we could incorporate that into the policy, and that would provide us another basic tool to the toolbox.
Thank you.
Would you suggest on the OPEB fund that we consider maybe allowing some corporates? I assume our policy is no corporates.
No,
this
it's
time.
The same. It's the same investment policy.
Oh, it is the same. Yeah. We just haven't switched it over yet. Or are you
correct? Right? So we've just.
They just the money hasn't been there that long.
Exactly, about right. 30 days. So we've just begun to really deploy it, and the additional dollars we will put within the market and deploy corporate exposures.
What is your expectations for the future in terms of interest rates, especially considering if the economy does pick up a little more? I mean,
it's a great question, and you know, I think where we are today is that we are in an environment that, as low as yields are, the one thing I would caution any committee or organization is that be careful in reaching, for yield. And if let's just examine the 10-year Treasury note. Okay, 10-year Treasury note has a 2% yield. It has a duration or a measure of interest rate sensitivity, we'll say, of eight years. So if we were to have a 50 basis point increase, we would have a 4% decline in principal value. That's how the math works. 4% decline in principal value, 2% positive of income, you complete a whole year with minus 2%. So here you have a risk-free instrument that if we were to just assume an interest rate movement of 50 basis points or 0.5%, which is not that large, you quickly end up in negative territory. That's how the math works. So if we begin to see an economy that really takes on some true sustainable growth, where the Federal Reserve would have to begin to shift their philosophy from keeping rates low for an extended period of time to begin to touch a bit on the brakes to remove that emergency liquidity that was enacted in 08, you could quickly move to negative rate of returns in the absolute yield level or performance level. So fixed income markets today, and I've been doing this for 26 years, I believe have an inherent level of risk that may not be truly understood, as we go forward into the next interest rate environment. It is our job constantly to bring back to the committee here and any organization those inherent risks and make sure that everyone understands it clearly, so as things change, level of expectations are fairly accurate.
I have one more question for, and this is just a general question. You probably manage many pension plans, many government pension plans. Just on a scale of 1 to 10, where the county is in conservatism, is it? I know it's very high, probably, just so that we get a sense of.
Which number is the high number? The conservative, is 1 conservative or 10 conservative?
10 is conservative.
Okay. In terms of being conservative, I would say the county is probably around 8.
Okay.
Other counties that we manage, I would put them probably around 4. So in relative degrees, they would hold twice as many corporates as we currently hold. In terms of credit quality, It's investment grade, but, you know, within the triple B sector. So it does expand, you know, the sandbox a bit.
I would add, I'd say our average client, I would say, is probably a 6 or 7 on the fixed income side, because everybody, my peers in our industry always say to me, Michael, you're conservative. But my average client's probably 6 or 7, and I'd actually probably put you at 9. So it's and so think of it, yes, you'd like to get additional return, but the guidelines that have been put upon them doesn't really give them much latitude to add. But the trade-off in today's market right now is if they try to pick up additional return, which you can do by going further out the yield curve, you take much greater risk of interest rates going up. But one of the possibilities you might want to think of, and I'm just throwing this out without having talked to Dom, is that maybe you allow them a little bit more flexibility into the spread product, the corporates and the agencies. And what I've seen some do is they'll look at it and say, okay, fine, instead of 25%, maybe they're allowed to go 40 or 50, but they'll put the corporates on the shorter end. So you take away some of the risk, the concern about default risk, because you have the shorter end there, and then they'll go to the longer side on the treasuries, you know, so.
Are you advising against municipals as well?
No, I'm not. No, I think that's a decision that's made by the investment manager, but no, I'm not advising against that. Yeah. And I'd say, actually, most of our, you know, taxable municipals, you know, most of our managers have the flexibility to go a certain percentage into that arena.
Maybe this is a related question or unrelated. In terms of funding adequacy versus risk, if this fund is adequately funds the liabilities, then all other things being equal, the need to stretch, it might be less for this portfolio than another.
That's a great point. Tim.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and I would concur. Your funded ratio is higher than most. You know, we have a lot of county clients in Pennsylvania, and your funded ratio is very strong. Your ability to put additional money in that you don't even have to, that you've done that, and that's been very strong. So, I say your need to drive. I like the need to drive down the road. You don't need to drive as fast as others.
Right.
But the thing you need to recognize is that your actuary is assuming an 8% return, okay? And I was preparing my thoughts on this as I was driving down the road, but since you asked this, think of it that, and I was thinking, a 1-hour drive from here, if there was no lights, probably put you about at the canal. Is that about right, maybe, roughly? So, and assuming if you were driving, you know, you say, well, it's a 65-mile drive, I'm gonna drive 65 miles an hour, the actuary, using an 8% return, is actually assuming about a 65% equities. You need to get that level of equities to get to an 8% return in today's market, I believe. But you guys are driving down the road about 55 miles an hour, okay? You might have a target of 60% equities, but your actual application, because of some of the constraints you put on the bond manager, the amount you have in cash, you're driving about 55 miles an hour. So you either need to drive faster or realize and say, you know, we're comfortable driving 55 miles an hour. Let's do that. But then you need to change your actuarial assumed rate of returns. And I think that's actually part of the talk I was going to do about the matching up the assets and the liabilities as you've raised.
In terms of other activity within the pension plan, there was a reallocation of assets this past month. The portfolio itself is extremely liquid. So to Michael's point, the need to reach is not necessarily there. As the need to reach is not there, one can invest and continue to deploy highly liquid, readily saleable securities. We basically sold almost 50% of the portfolio to meet that need without any hesitation or negative implication in terms of performance.
I have it. Question for you. I noticed there are some maturities like 2021 and 2020 and whatnot that have, of course, a little bit higher yield. But are you limiting your investments in those, or do you plan on interest rates go up? Are you planning on holding those? Or
well, we look at the in modern portfolio theory, you're constructing the portfolio based off many parts. The index itself that we compare ourselves has a maximum maturity of 10 years. The investment policy also allows that. It would be imprudent to place all of the funds out in 10 years to create some bullet structure. So we're looking to make sure that it's fairly well laddered so that we can meet any cash needs within those longer term periods. The yield curve still remains very steep. So one is being rewarded at that incremental level of maturity. But nonetheless, relative to the example that I had previously mentioned, the degree of risk associated with those from a change in yields is greater than the shorter issue. So we need to monitor that relatively close as we move forward and the potential interest rate environment changes. Where we stand today is that the Federal Reserve has been, at least Chairman Greenspan and those that are a bit more dovish on the committee, that they wish to keep rates low for an extended period of time and very accommodative into the latter part of 2014. So if that holds true, we're going to see target Fed funds still at that 0 to 25 basis point range, and it moves within that range, and then the rest of the curve still pretty much where it is today.
Thank you, Dominic.
Thank you for your time.
Very good. Performance reports.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Sitting here debating which one of the two reports you want to go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Which one of the two reports to go over first? The OPEB is probably a little bit more important because there's some action steps we want to get to. But why don't we start with the pension one? That's the one that doesn't. There's one that says Sussex County OPEB. There's one that says Sussex County. That is the pension. I do have one more set in case somebody wants them, so I'll leave them with you. Dom did a nice job of going over the economy and the markets, but I'll touch on a couple things here. You'll see under the first tab on performance summary. Okay. See economic highlights, and the world stock markets did boom in the first quarter. So you have very strong equity markets this quarter. Unemployment rate did fall a little bit to 8.2, but there is still quite a bit of concern about a slowing job growth. As was mentioned earlier, the job growth was fairly strong in January and February, slowed up in March. You know, the climb up never is a straight line up. It will go like this. But is it going like this, and then is it going to slow its rate of growth, or was March just an anomaly? I don't have the answer to that one. I guess we'll know tomorrow, at least another piece of data around that. But I do believe the economy is improving. Has been improving for a while. It's just the rate of growth that it's improving. You can see the next bullet point below that is gas prices took a dramatic jump up this past quarter. We're actually seeing them come back down a little bit right now. So the headline inflation you see out there is 4.9%. That's what people actually feel because that includes, food and gas. But core inflation only is at 2%. And core inflation is the underlying inflation rate. When you take out both gas and food prices are very cyclical, very seasonal. So they'll jump up and down. So they try to smooth that effect out and take those out. You might say, well, why would you do that? People have to buy food. They need gasoline. Well, it's for different purposes to look at it. The first part, the first number, the 4.9, is the true inflation that people will feel. But the Fed needs to get a measure of, is inflation as underlying the core part of it, increasing at a rate that is concerning on a long-term basis? And do they need to take Fed action, meaning slowing up the economy, raising interest rates through fiscal policy, through monetary policy? And right now, the answer is no. 2% is sort of the target rate that they'd like to have. Bank lending actually went up during the quarter, although stalling in March. But consumer loans decreased some. Auto sales year over year increased by 13%. A decent amount of that was purchase of hybrids. So that might be just a one-time event kind of thing versus the economy getting stronger. And housing starts are beginning to show some signs of recovery. Everybody needs to keep in mind that the economic and financial downturn we had was the worst since the Depression. So it wasn't like we were going to bounce back to the 1990s or even earlier this past decade overnight. It's going to take 5 to 10 years to crawl back out of that. What are some of the things looking ahead? You know, will corporate profits, which have been very strong, will they be able to sustain the rally? Okay. Interest rates, you know, one of the economics professors, the assistant dean of the economics department, we've just hired to do economics, some white papers for us, and I was talking to him about it. Just an interesting aside, he was my professor. I did my master's in econ back in the late 70s, and at the time, I thought he was much older than me. And then I just found out he's 5 years older than me, so it's all a different perspective of things. as he said, I can give you a number, I can give you a time, but I'm not going to give you both. Meaning, like, yes, interest rates will get up to so and so, but will it be in a year? Will it be in 3 years? Will it be 5 years? You know, nobody really knows. But it's, you know, being as low as they are right now, is it a pretty good bet that they're going to rise? Yeah, it's a pretty good bet it's going to rise. How much and how fast? Well, that's the tough part, you know. So you hear, I'll say this even in your questions, you know, the concern about, well, if you have long-term bonds, what does that do to your portfolio? But the concern, you know, if that returns are so low, how do you pick up, you know, how do you pick up some additional return? How do you meet your actuarial assumed rate of return? Because if you don't meet your actuarial assumed rate of return, your ARC, your annual required contribution, is going to go up. Now, fortunately, you are in much better shape than almost any county out there nationwide to be able to sustain that. You're actually interesting enough in a position to take more risk if you want to. I'm not suggesting that, but you could because you have, you know, better financial position to take that risk. On the other hand, you look and say, but we're well-funded. Do we need to? Do we have to take risk? Okay. But to some degree, and I'll change that word from risk to uncertainty, okay? To some degree, you want to take some of it because you could be so conservative, you could park it all in short-term, you know, treasuries, and you're going to get 0.5%, 0.25%, and then your contributions are going to go up dramatically, and the actuary would have to change their assumed rate of returns. If you're so conservative in your investing, they're going to say, no, you can't get 8% on this. We're going to assume a much lower number. Earlier I had mentioned the issue, though, and I think we've had this discussion a little bit, that it is something I think your actuary, Susie, I think your actuary is looking at that issue about your assumed rate of returns. Is that, am I correct?
The 8%?
Yeah.
Yeah. I asked them this year because our actuary year runs on a calendar year, so they're finalizing the report. And I just asked them in general. Everybody's talking about it, of course, it uses actuary. And they said of all of them, they've changed one.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still talked about a lot. And I believe there's even a GASB that's going to address some aspects of that. So,
yeah. And if you split the two pieces apart, there's the actuarial calculations and GASB, which is the accounting part of it. The accounting industry is going to force you to book your liabilities different than you did before. You're going to have to look at the funded ratio, okay? First off, you're going to have to mark to market your assets instead of smoothing them. Not for the contribution that you have to make, but from an accounting perspective, what's on your balance sheet and your income statement, okay? So, and then they're going to look at, okay, what is the discount rate, the assumed rate of return that you're going to get on your portfolio? If you're fully funded, you can continue to use that 8%. But let's just say, for argument's sake, you're 90%. I think, aren't you around 90, 95?
93.
Okay, so
was last year.
Yeah. So for ease, let's just say 90%. They're going to allow you to use that 8% on 90% of your liability. But on that other 10%, you have to use the interest rate on long-term muni bonds, which is a much, much lower rate. So if you use it on that last 10%, if you're using a lower discount rate, it actually increases your liability. It's the denominator in the equation. The net effect is your liabilities go up, as reportable on your financial statements. Yes?
I know this is a silly question, but, and you might have already answered it in what you said, but I missed it. Are you saying that the mark-to-market, let's say losses, when you take the mark-to-market, that the actuaries, do they take that into consideration in the funding gap?
Well, two different issues. For the actuaries, no, they don't have to mark-to-market. They smooth your assets, okay?
Over like five years.
So they
that unrealized drop is still hurting us. That 24% drop 3 years ago when they're at is still.
So gains or losses, whether realized or unrealized,
right,
are smoothed over a five-year time period. Okay, that's for determining okay what your asset value is. Okay, I like it. Think of it first. There's the bucket. The bucket is the liability, the obligation, how much you owe to each individual and then cumulatively. So that's the first piece, the bucket. Then the next question is how much do you actually have in the bucket? Okay. If you mark to market, it's at the end of December, whatever it is, it is. But the actuaries are allowed to say, well, we know it vacillates because the markets vacillate. We'll smooth that those impacts over 5 years. Okay. But when they calculate the size of the bucket, they also have to say, what is the discount rate we think you have? What is the assumed rate of return? Okay? So you have to present value those liabilities back to today, bring them back into today's dollars. And this is where, so from an actuarial perspective, this doesn't change. But from a financial statement, there's really two issues. One is, on the financial statements, the asset values are marked to market, will be marked to market. And then the liability is going to change also, because if you're not 100% funded, then the piece that's not funded is then calculated at a lower discount rate. And effectively, the lower discount rate means you're going to say the bucket's bigger. If the bucket's bigger, then your funded ratio goes down. Okay. Won't have a dramatic impact on yourselves. We'll have a little bit, but won't have a dramatic one because you're close to fully funded. You think, you know, and you know, we have a number of clients in Pennsylvania, you know, and elsewhere. I mean, I'll say Delaware as a whole does a pretty damn good job of you know, taking care of the fiscal responsibilities. But there's some cities out there, and I reference Pennsylvania, they're like 50% funded, 40% funded. And that's assuming 8% return. If now they have to take half of that and assume 4% return, they never get there. I don't know how they ever pay their obligations. Yeah,
where I was going with this,
sure,
is I noticed in the Wilmington Trust presentation, there's a lot of money in Fannie Mae and Fannie Mae obligations. I think there's a lot more chaff in. I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. I was just trying to figure out what impact that would have. I mean, a continuation of the losses in that. So I get what you're saying. Actuarially, doesn't matter, but it could matter on the liability side.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, tying into that is when an actuary assumes 8% return, they're figuring, okay, you're going to get 10 to 10.5% on equities, and you're going to get 5 to 5.5% on fixed income. And you've, you know, 60-40 split, really almost 65-35 split gets you to that 8%. Well, one is you're not at 65-35, okay? And two, I don't think you can assume a 5 to 5.5% return on fixed income over the next 5 to 10 years. So how do you make up that difference? You know, you either have to, as I say, drive down the road faster or say, you know, we're comfortable driving 55, 60 miles an hour. That's who we are. That's what we're comfortable with. But then we need to reflect that in the actuarial reports. Now, a lot of my clients are looking at this same issue as yourself, as do they change their assumed rate of returns? You know, and actually a lot of the counties I deal with are at 7.5. A lot of municipalities are at 8%. The difficulty for a lot of them is that if you drop your assumed rate of return, your arc is going to go up. In essence, because the bucket's bigger, okay? The amount of water in the bucket's the same, so you have to pour more water in the bucket to fill it up, okay?
The county did contribute some extra money to the funds this year. I'm wondering if it might be a good time to look at that, where it doesn't have a drastic one-year impact by going from 8 to 7 or 7.5% or something like that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you incrementally start bringing, you know, you might bring it down like 0.25% first and see what impact that is.
Right. I think, and that, what you're saying is kind of, don't make it such a cliff, but
right.
There's a school of thought that thinks if you don't address those actuarial numbers that you're playing games in some respect. I mean, and I've had that discussion before. So how many people out there are adjusting them down incrementally that you're looking at?
They're all starting to, very few of them have actually made the move. The ones who are above 8 have, the actuaries have really sort of almost say jammed them down to 8, forced them to go there. The ones that are 8, the actuaries are trying to, I'll say, massage them to the point of that they will drop them.
But you've talked about what a unique position we're in. If we're in Pennsylvania and we don't have those funds to contribute, I mean, that would really make them, I think, a little lethargic. Maybe I should have restated my question and said, what is the prudent thing to do in your view?
The prudent thing to do, I think, based upon, you know, the way you like to invest and where the markets are, is to start moving that assumed rate of return down. You know, an actuary can make those calculations and tell you, if you drop it to 7.75, here's what it means. If you drop it to 7.5, here's what it means. And that way you can measure that. Because if you do that, you want to make sure that you'll be able to afford the extra, you know, it's the trick. But the prudent thing, I think, would be definitely to start moving that down some. And how much, I think, we'd have to see actual numbers, and that's part of the budgetary process and everything else.
Thank you.
Sure.
Have the actuaries given you estimates? Are they
for the budget?
Are they?
They were 2% higher.
2% in total for both?
No, the pension.
Pension was
the
up.
The OPEB, I think, ticked 1% or something. It wasn't as drastic.
3%.
But, and it's because of the smoothing, even though with the extra contributions that we had made to the pension fund, more people on the pension fund in the last 3 years. Well, of course, I have a whole list, but when we get the actuary's report, which should be soon because we have a calendar year end, we can discuss it at our next meeting.
So even with that extra contribution, that went in 2011.
Mm-hmm. That went in December of 2011 and got counted. Mm-hmm. This is just another piece of it. I'm not real happy with our actuaries. It's time to shop again, I believe. I know we've talked about this before, David, a while ago. We didn't feel like we were getting good service, and they kind of changed us around and targeted us to somebody else, and it was good for a year. And I don't know if because they're a chain, it's Aon. And, mm-hmm. I don't think we're getting good service. But
what some of the actuaries can do for you is, because it'd be one thing to say, okay, so what's it mean this year if you just change your discount rate? But what does that also mean 3 years, 5 years,
right.
10 years, 20 years from now? Okay. And what if we have, what if we have strong markets? What if we have weak markets? What if we have intermediate markets? City of Allentown's a client of ours, and the actuary there was able to actually show and say, well, here's the impact of in different types of markets. If you make these changes, what does it mean to you from a funded level, from a contribution level, you know, whether it's Aon or somebody else? You know, it'd be one of the questions that you might want to consider having your actuary do for you. Will there be some additional cost for them to do that? Yes. In my opinion, you know, for, you know, $80 million plan to have them spend, like in Allentown's case, I think it was like $7,500, three plans, it was $7,500 to get those calculations done, to really look out into the future. You know, I thought it was money well spent because then they could make some informed decisions that way. So, if you want me to help you with some of that for a ridge, or if you go out to bid, you know, we can help you vet that out, you know, what, if you think that's something you might want to consider. So it's not what we do, but they can do for you. So. Okay. Moving on to page 4 and 5, just a couple highlights here on the markets. On the broad market, you can see the red, which is emerging market equities, up, biggest winner, up 14.1%. But all the other equities were also up double digit. The U.S. equity market was up 12.9. That's not the S&P 500. That's the Russell 3000. So that means that includes large, mid, and small size companies. International non-emerging market. I don't call it the international developed market anymore because emerging markets include China and Brazil and India. And I don't think they would take kindly to be caught in an emerging market now, especially since China is the second largest economy in the world. So we'll call it emerging market and non-emerging market. That was double digit, 10.9. And fixed income was very flat. Okay. In fact, if you extrapolate 0.3, which is U.S. aggregate index, that's 1.2 for the year. As I mentioned, you're expecting 5 to 5.25, interest rates have started to rise, not much, but have started to go up a little bit. So you're seeing, basically flat returns there. Last year, the story was completely different. And last year was for the full year from April 1st to March 31st. The loser was the emerging markets, down 8.5, because third quarter emerging markets were off dramatically. That's a pretty common event that when we see real sell-offs in the market, the ones that have done the best in the good markets are the ones that do the worst in the bad markets. And emerging markets, with the concern about worldwide, there was concern about worldwide recession there, and you had the European crisis then. You had the crisis in Washington last and third quarter. Seems so long ago, we almost forget it, but emerging markets were down 8.5, international down 5.8. But the U.S. market up 7.2. Two reasons for that. One is the currency play, okay? If you're buying with stronger dollars, earnings overseas, and you bring them back to the U.S., you're going to get, the earnings effect there. So that had a negative effect on international investing. But the U.S. actually is coming out of the Great Recession stronger than most of the other, I will use the word, developed countries, much better than Europe. And it was the fixed income, the U.S. fixed income, that was a big winner. Interest rates came down dramatically in the third quarter. Concerned about that, both from Fed action and also because a lessened demand for borrowing. So that was a strong area for last year. International was positive, but not as strongly positive. As for styles, the red are growth stocks, the blue are value stocks. The darker the color, the larger company. You'll see the word, large growth stocks. I might use the word cap. Cap is capitalization, but it means the size of the company. So large cap, mid cap, small cap. So for the quarter, the winner was the large cap growth area, okay? Especially technology. Apple. You can see a bit of the Apple effect right there, okay? Apple was up, I think, 48% the first quarter, and the biggest holding in that index. All double digits, but growth outperformed value. For the year, the big winner, again, was the large growth stocks, up 11%. And as you work your way down the curve, the smaller the company, the worse it did, and the more value-y it was, the worse it did. In fact, where you get to small value. Over a longer period of time, actually, you look at 20, 30 years, mid-value is actually the biggest winner. But these things go in cycles. Okay. Your portfolio is very style neutral. But you have, and I'll show you some observations, especially on the OPEB side, you have an over allocation to small cap, and we want to talk about that and what you might want to do that about that. And fixed income, we've talked about that quite a bit and with the previous manager, but on just page 5, you'll see that on the right-hand side on year 1, the longer the maturity bond, the better it did. So long maturity bonds were up 19.3% for the year, but it was also the worst performer last quarter. Graph on the bottom is the same one that Dominic showed you. The blue was the end of March. The red was the end of December. You can see the yield curve shifted up all the way across the yield curve.
whole lot of numbers for you on the next two pages. Basically, I've covered all that. By the way, we will try, and in most cases, be able to get you reports prior to the meeting. Two reasons why we didn't this time. One is very early in the quarter. You're my second client I'm meeting with. The other one was on Saturday. So we were just finishing up. So the universes actually just came out on Monday. Okay. The second reason is we actually have changed the layout of our reports. We changed the provider that we've actually spent the last 24 months looking at our reports, how to make them, I'll say, easier to work with, not from our side, but from our client's side. Easier to read, more usable, better data. You know, we were quite happy with what we had before, but we're always looking to improve. So this process of switching over providers, takes some time also. So observations. Your overweight fixed income. And being overweight fixed income last quarter hurt you. Okay. Third quarter, it helped you, but it hurt you relative to your benchmark last quarter. You're also overweight international equities, but that has been addressed. If you recall, we discussed that at the last meeting, and you took the money, even though we had no displeasure with the Vanguard Global Equity Fund you had, you were overweight international relative to your investment policy statement, because the state has a target of 20% international, and they have about 63% of your money. So just make it for ease that we'll make it 60%. So 60% of 20% is 12%. Your target is 12% international. So you already had that, so you didn't need to have the international component that a global fund would have. Just refresh everybody's memory, a global manager will buy U.S. and non-U.S. stocks. Okay. And the state underperformed the benchmark for the first quarter and actually fourth quarter also. A decent amount of underperformance, but I also want to make mention that their long-term returns have been very good. I think the way you've structured thing on the pension side makes a lot of sense. You have they're your core portfolio, but they will also go into areas that typically you don't necessarily want to. I mean, they'll have private equity, they'll have hedge fund. It's a large enough pool of money that they can do that and have all of the oversight that goes with that. And then what you do is you take that and then you build your rest of your pieces to fit your personality, because you're more conservative than the state runs their money. In the state, because the state has different dynamics than you do. Okay. Looking ahead, need to do a little bit of rebalancing, get a little bit more into equities, not because we're market timing, not because we're saying we think equities are better than fixed income, but if your target's 60%, you want to stay as close to that as possible. And it's time to review and update the investment policy statement that was originally written by us in 2008, I think. And I think it'd be appropriate that there's some changes we would make to it. Not dramatic, but just some cleanup. Things evolve over, 3-4 year time period. So if the committee says go ahead, we'll come back with a draft. It won't be a huge overhaul, but some suggested changes to the investment policy statement, which may also lead into at least some discussion. You may not change us, but at least some discussion about the fixed income side. Do you want to loosen up the reins a little bit on Wilmington Trust? You may not. You may say, no, we're fine with that.
It was May 07.
Pardon me?
It was finalized May 07.
Okay, so 5 years. Even more reason to. In fact, every year, like when we did before, when we were meeting annually, we'd give you some observations. But every year, it's should be at least reviewed. Say, okay, here's the key points. What are the issues? If we think there's any issues that you need to at least either refresh your thoughts on that, or maybe even some recommendations if I think it's some change. But I would say very prudent to make some changes to that. Yeah. Not dramatic, but so performance, page 10. For the quarter, you were up 6.1%, which is a very nice return. But your policy index was up 7.6. So it lagged the policy index. In a moment, I'll show you actually compared to peer groups, you had roughly sort of average return for the quarter. The year, 4.6 versus 5.6, and 3 years, 14.7 versus 17.5. Primary reasons, I'll say for the quarter underperformance, as I mentioned, the state lagged their benchmark. If you go down to the bottom, they were at 7% versus 7.4. But the biggest issue was
the amount you have in fixed income, the amount you have in cash relative to your policy index. Policy index says 60-40. We make that calculation and say, well, what if you were 60-40 and you're all indexed? Now, one of the things, and this gets back to the investment policy statement, your investment policy statement says 60-40, bonds and stocks. It doesn't have a piece in there for cash. And since the time you wrote that, how you've dealt with benefit payments is different than you did in 2007. You're actually taking your contributions now, you're putting them into short-term, very short-term fixed income, either laddered CDs or money market, so that you have the cash available to pay that out. You don't have to go back to the managers and force them to liquidate, you know, which I think is, you know, you want to have to force them to liquidate. So you've got short-term assets for short-term needs. But you also have quite a bit, you know, you have almost 5% in cash right now. Well, if cash is paying nothing, but your benchmark is benchmarked to the fixed income, you're going to look relatively underperforming. So I'd like to have a cash piece in within the fixed income of 40% that says, okay, here's how much, you know, whether it's 37.3 or 35.5, that you recognize that you are having cash as part of your overall portfolio. Okay.
The cash is being invested, it's just low returns.
Well, if you can get a CD, you know, that's just not a viable option like it was, but yeah, it's earning interest, but in the account that it is, but you can't even get certificates of deposits.
So, for example, interest. Wilmington Trust was up 5.9 last year, okay? But part of that fixed income was in cash, yielding basically zero. So since you do have to have that, it's just like running a business. You have to have an operating account to pay for your expenses. Let's recognize that in an investment policy statement and then recognize that in your benchmark.
Now, before...
Sorry, and I didn't mean to...
That's okay. Before we pulled the year, basically use the contribution as the working capital, so to speak, for the pension reimbursement. Before we did that, because we had invested it all, so I had a period of time where I didn't have any cash, I did pull from Wilmington Trust. It's about $225,000 a month for pensioners, and they seemed to get it. You know, it was in a couple of days. It wasn't a big deal, so maybe, you know, what you were saying, I don't know, maybe it's better to go back the other way. Since on the cash end, it's just not a lot of options.
But they would still, in that portfolio, they would need to sit on cash knowing that you're going to
draw.
So they would do one of two things. They'd be forced to sell bonds, and maybe when they don't want to sell them, or because they, you know, if their target, they said, well, we want a duration of 3.8, and all of a sudden, well, if they sell just one bond, it throws off their overall portfolio, or they sell off little pieces of the bond. The reality is they would sit on cash in their portfolio, and then you'd pay them for doing that. So, in fact, you'd have double paying them because it's sitting in a money market, and the money market has a fee, and then Wilmington Trust has their fee, you know, for as a manager. So I think what you're doing right now still makes the most sense. But let's.
What if I just did an annual reimbursement? You know, rather than every, I don't have to take it every month. That's because it was clean with the way we paid pensioners. But maybe that's the place to rethink it. We pay pensioners monthly. I know what I pay. I'll reimburse myself. You know, it's nice when accountants like to wrap all those kinds of things up. But maybe I take it once a year and say, okay, I need $2.2 million to reimburse before the end of my fiscal year. So I have my, because that's a budgeted number also. So I have my reimbursements covered for the year, and then I'm not pulling on an investment and give Wilmington Trust like a heads up of.
They can invest it in a note for one
year.
Yeah,
something.
It may not even necessarily be Wilmington Trust. It's a perfect, actually, I think that might be a very good idea because that's a great time to rebalance your portfolio. So you don't automatically take it from Wilmington Trust. You, let's say if you were at 60-40 and if equities run up, then you take it, you know, you get with us and we'll help you make, you know.
Right.
Do you take it from DuPont? Do you take it from Fidelity? Do you take it, you know, maybe you take it from the state, but you can, you know, you can take, you know, perfect opportunity to rebalance
your
portfolio.
I just need to take it by June 30, so this is a perfect time going into it because I only have to pay pensioners May and June.
Mm-hmm.
You do it the old way to wrap up the fiscal year, And then starting in July, I don't take it again till the next June, because I really don't need to take it. It was just a cleaner.
Just have to have it by June 30th.
Yeah, I have to have the cash in the bank so it's counted and balanced on my...
Because you're take instead of taking it out of the pension itself, you pay the benefit payments out of the county and then reimburse the county. Okay. I think that can
up that income.
And then you'd have to have very little cash in the pension fund then, you know.
Enough to keep the account open. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
And it's good to have the cash account though when we do rebalance because I circulate all the funds through the cash account. I don't hop between them if we're rebalancing. I bring everything back to cash.
Mm-hmm.
Then I, you know, take the new investments away or put it into the investment. So we would need that.
Yeah. No. I like that idea.
So you're suggesting that it you rebalance every June, or that the $1 million or the $2 million, whatever the contribution is, that is invested throughout the funds, like 60-40 equities and fixed income, and then at the end of June you would rebalance and then send Susie a check for send the county a check for the $2 million.
So when the contribution comes in at the end of, you know, November and December, you go and invest it.
Yep.
Okay? And then when you get to the end of June, you're looking and say, okay, where are we relative to that 60-40 split? And then take the money from the side that it's gone into, you know, where you're over-allocated to. So you'd really sort of, you're almost rebalancing twice a year. Once when you're making the contribution, you know, late in the year, and then you get an opportunity to rebalance again, you know, when you take money out.
Just pull it from the places that might have had certain returns in that period where they got out of balance because of their market value.
Sure, yeah.
And so, and pull whatever I need.
So the State of Delaware Investment Pool, just to bring me up to speed,
mm-hmm.
that looks like it might be close to 60-40 as well. Do you have a top of mind break out in terms of how it's allocated?
There, although it changes quite a bit, we were waiting on the information from them because it comes out about 6 weeks after the end of the quarter. In the report that we did at the end of September, we have that actual in that report. And if you'd like to get that, we can get that for you. At the end, the report that's, I'll say that, you like the most is the one in September, because that's when you're going to make a contribution, figure where to put it in. And that one we will, that gets late enough in the quarter that we have that information from the state and can provide it. They're targeted 60-40, but they go a pretty wide berth. They go up, I've seen times they've been up to 80% equities. I've seen other times when they've been down, I think maybe as low as 40. So they take a pretty wide berth. And then there's certain areas that it's, I'll say, a little bit tougher to, you know, like a hedge fund, where do you allocate that? So we try to get the best information we can, because hedge funds can have both, you know, some could be all equity, some can be a combination of both, you know. But their policy index is 60-40. As I say, although their one-year return is below their benchmark and their quarter return is below the benchmark, you can see some longer term, you know, their 2011, they did very well. 2010, they did very well. So I think it's a very good core piece to build around.
You, just for a little history for you, a few years ago when we didn't have as much money in the fund, we piggybacked with the state.
Sure.
and basically continued that for a number of years. So that's why the amount is so high. And overall, it worked pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
yeah. Going on to the next page, and I'll just hit you on a couple other things, because what's
11:10.
Okay, and what time do you want me to wrap up about?
11.
11? Okay. So let me just, two more.
I'm just kidding.
No, I want to be very respectful of your time. So now this time around, it was going to take a little bit more because there's some things we need to talk about. But two things on this, and then we'll go on to the OPEB. If you go to page 11, okay. Go to the graph on the upper right-hand side, and you see that blue square. So, well, what is that? What does that mean? The crosshairs is the benchmark, 60-40. So if you did exactly what the policy index did every single quarter, you'd be at 100% and 100%, meaning you'd 100% in the up markets and 100% of the down markets. In actuality, you're about 80-80. That means in the up markets, you're doing about 80% of what the policy index is doing. In the down markets, you're doing about 80%. So if the market's down 10, you're only down 8. But if the market's up 10, you're only up 8. You might say, well, that's okay, we're conservative. But I caution in saying that you have a conservative policy index to begin with, and then your implementation of it is making it even more conservative. So instead of driving down the road at 60 miles an hour, you're driving, that's why I mentioned driving 55. Again, you may be very comfortable driving 55, but then you have to go back and look at these other issues on the actuarial side to say, okay, that's who we are, that's what we're comfortable with, then do that. Or you might look and say, you know, Michael, we're never going to be comfortable going 65 miles an hour, but maybe we should go 57, 58, 60. You know, get us there a little bit faster. But the faster you go, the more risk you take. And that's the trade-off, that ultimately it's the committee and then the council that needs to make that decision.
Are there any specific things that you could relay that would account for 80-80 as opposed to 100-100?
I'd say the two biggest things on this plan are the amount that you have in cash, the cash effect on this, okay? Because your policy index doesn't reflect cash, okay? And the second one is the way the bond manager is managing that. I'll say there's fairly significant constraints on them, so that makes it more conservative also. Those are probably the biggest two.
Thank you.
But for changes, I this has worked, when we did the report, more for your benefit because we heard the last one, but the long-term returns of this fund have been very good. Your rankings, let's go to page 12 because it's always good to see the good news. For the last quarter, you were up 6.1%, put you in the 68th percentile. Keep in mind, one is the highest return, 99th is the lowest percentile. So a little bit, below the average. But when you consider that you're more conservative than the average plan in a period where it was the more aggressive ones that did better, that's really not that bad. And you look for the year, you're at the 42nd percentile. So even though you're below your policy index, you're still above average for the year. You're even more above average at 3 years. You look at 2011, which was, although positive, was a really flat year. You were in the top 11%, 77th in the 10th, 2010, 49th. So good long-term performance, above average performance with a lot less risk than most plans. So when I talk about here's some of the things I think you need to look at, it's not like you need a huge overhaul. These are just more subtle things that, what else can you do to enhance things? All in all, I think, you got a good structure and it's worked well for you, And if anyone wants to read the rest of the page and call me with questions, you can. Because then I want to get on to the OPEB report. Any other questions about the pension fund? Okay. Now, the first couple pages in this report are the same. The first, actually, 7 through page 7 are the same as the previous one. It's just market information. But if you go on to page 9, and this is the OPEB fund. It gained, I'll just round off, $1.5 million last quarter, $1.5 million. It was significantly overweight fixed income. Okay. And that's partially because you had the contributions come in, you had additional contributions come in, plus you were transitioning some things, hiring the fixed income manager, moving them from cash to fixed income. But your target on fixed income, which is 40%. On January 1st, you were at 50%. On March 31st, you were 44.4. So you're moving in that direction. That direction partially caused because equities have done better. So if equities going better, fixed income is going to have a smaller percentage of the portfolio. And also because you did a little bit of movement around of the funds. You are significantly overweight small cap stocks. So when we talk about what I think you need to consider, I'd like to hand this page out to you. And we did talk some about this last time. Last time, I think that the talk was about some revamping of the manager lineup. As you can see from the reports,
Thank
too,
you.
The format's a little bit different, a little bit crisper. Cleaner, but that gives us some additional data to share and observations. So, looking ahead, when you did your manager search, was it 2 years ago now, Susie, when that process started? Probably
two and a half years.
You were somewhat constrained by it was whoever ended up responding back to the RFP. It didn't give the latitude for your consultant to say, here's some other names that we think you might want to consider also. I think it's part of why you've talked, and changed sort of dynamics of how we can interact with you. So you had to pick from the best of what responded. With that, tried to craft together, best we could. But there's certain ones we think are candidates for changes. Allianz, which is your large cap core manager. Your large cap index, you currently have part of your large cap, your large company U.S. stocks indexed. Right now you're indexing your large cap value stocks. Okay. We would actually rather see you index the large cap core, the S&P 500, sort of the piece to build around. And then maybe have a defensive, conservative value manager to complement them on a large cap side. And you might say, well, why didn't we do that 2 years ago? Because the one or two respondents on the large cap value side were just I don't want to say they were so bad, that wouldn't be fair, but weren't a choice you wanted to go with. So you said, let's index the value side, and we'll go with the best core active manager. We'd rather see you flip-flop those two. We've run numbers on these quite a few times for yourselves and for other clients, and we feel that combination works better. Okay.
What was that again?
Sure.
Which combination?
So what you have is your large cap value is indexed, mm-hmm. and your core manager is the active manager. Okay. We'd like to see it the other way around. Have buy the S&P 500. Get that from Vanguard or Fidelity. It's like 5, 6, 7 basis points. I mean, it is dirt cheap. You have the top 500 companies in size in it, and it's a nice piece to build around the rest of your portfolio. And then hire a defensive value manager on the as the other piece on the large cap side. There are aggressive value managers, and there's conservative ones. We like the conservative ones, I'll say especially for yourselves, but that's our philosophy also, is that they give you some of the protection on the downside. If you're going to reach for some additional return, how much additional return are the managers going to give you in the largest 500 stocks in the U.S.? It's not like somebody's going to say, wow, I just discovered Apple. Everybody follows that, and Exxon and Microsoft, et cetera. The value side, it's not like they're going to discover some company that nobody else knows, but there's ones that are designed to be more protective in a down market. So we like that as a piece of the overall equation. So what we're going to talk about, it's really a couple-fold process. One is picking, I won't say the best, but the right managers. But it's then the engineering of the portfolio. How do you put the pieces together to fit your philosophy, your ability and willingness to take risk or uncertainty. We also like mid-cap. Mid-cap, I call the Goldilocks. Not too big, not too small. Although Apple keeps growing and growing, how much bigger can they really get? How much can the biggest companies out there really grow? But they tend to do the best when the economy goes down. That's the good side of the large companies. The small companies, they can do really well when they come out of a recession and really take off, and they can be more nimble. But they're also the ones that get hit the hardest in a downturn. The mid-sized companies are the ones that have room to grow, but their volatility is actually much like the large cap companies, because they're big enough they can usually sustain a strong downturn. So we not only like to have mid-cap companies in here, we actually like to see a little bit of overweighting in that area. Now, if you go to this page and you go to your the green, okay, and you'll see those percentages. That's the percentage of their targets, and the targets are we derive by looking what, you know, how much of the market is large cap, mid cap, small cap. You are quite a bit overweighted in small cap. Again, partially because it was you know, the limitations, the constraints from the search, you know, what came out of it. So we'd actually like to see some come out of the small cap and be moved into the mid and maybe a little bit into the large area also. Okay. Small cap can do very well, but it's also a more volatile space to be. So as we go through this process, we'd like to bring in some mid-cap names to I'll say, a little bit more broadly diversify this portfolio. You're also, if you look at the blue, you can see you're international at 9.9%. Your target is 12. We'd like to see after you've done that process and said, okay, here, okay, this we want this fund, we want this fund, then we would blend them together and say, okay, what puts you on that 12% target? Okay. I will also, just observationally, the average plan at 60% equities is about 14% international now. So, and a lot of our clients are actually 16 to 18, but those are the ones that are maybe 65% equities. So, not suggesting it change, you know, but just an observation on that, yes.
You'll want to do this after the reallocation that I already did for, I think it's Ridgeworth and Dodge and Cox.
Yes. Before, right? Yeah. Yes.
So you're you're suggesting we may want to consider a policy change that would increase from 12% to higher in the international, even in light of what's going on in Europe?
I'll be ever the diplomat or politician on this one. I was making an observation of what I see out there. I wasn't sure I was going to go so far to make that recommendation. But now,
but
one way, if you go over to the lineup of managers, and here's one way to deal with that, if you say, yeah, it might make sense, but boy, with all that's going on in Europe, you know, really, Michael, you're going to suggest that now? You have global equity managers. So you have Dodge & Cox, and you have Harding Loevner. Global managers can invest in U.S. and non-U.S. So you put it, instead of, I'll say, in our hands or in your hands, you might target at 14, but those managers, if they like the U.S. better now, they're going to be more weighted to the U.S. So your 14 actually might be back down to 12, okay? But at some point in time, they're going to like overseas better, then they might overweight the other direction. So that's how you can do it, but be a little bit nimble with it.
So you want to come back.
That's how I would do it.
In the next meeting with suggestions for
yes.
Actual names of investment managers.
Yeah. And that's, like, I think, you know, you can read this report, but the bottom line is that's what I think, and we've talked about this before, is that what I would like to have is if the committee said, yes, Michael, go ahead and do that, is that we will, in the large cap space, we'll look at some options, you know, S&P index fund, but for some value managers, so flip-flop those two spaces like I mentioned before. And actually, I think those are the two things I do. And you're going to need to rebound. You're still light on your equities. And you could either do some of that now or wait till the next quarter when we come back. But just recognize that you are still a little bit light on your equity allocations.
So that's the fund that needs some work right now, a little bit of.
Yeah, that space
TLC.
Right there. Yeah, really the big thing would be come back to the large cap value with like three choices from you to look at. And we would bring you one or two in the index fund because I want to look at Vanguard, I want to look at Fidelity. And just we were just, the big thing there is fees and making sure how close they track to their benchmarks. So we'd probably just bring you one there and say, here's. Most of our clients use Vanguard, but some use Fidelity, and there's not a big, big difference between the two in that space, indexing.
Well, at least it would be easy to fix, though, because You don't have to liquidate anything. You can just reallocate cash, the cash that's sitting there.
Unless we get we get out of some of the ones like Allianz or...
Yeah, well, I think you'd want to get out of Allianz, so you would liquidate. But the nice thing about with mutual funds is they can...
Yeah.
The custodian can...
Take you right out.
They can simultaneously buy and sell. Mm-hmm. If it's a separate account manager, they have to sell, you have to wait for a couple of days. There's a commission cost to do that, okay? With the mutual funds, and just for everybody's, because there's different share classes, these are no commission, no 12B1 institutional mutual funds. Okay, so just think you probably know, but we have no incentive to make any recommendations. You know, no monetary incentive. We have an incentive to improve the performance of the plan, but no monetary incentive.
Well, when you bring them back, you'll bring back returns with those funds, of course.
Right.
You know, like 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year returns, so that we can analyze what we're looking at.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to show you how they did in up markets, how they did in down markets. You know, how do they manage money? Are they buying just the largest of the large cap? Or are they buying some large and mid cap? So you'll get a fairly, you know, I won't say overly detailed, but a properly documented search of information. And then come back and also say, and here's what we would recommend on rebalancing. So much to this, so much to this, so much to this. Do you need to take some money from here so that you can get yourself back on your target? So so that would be part of it.
Do you consider fees and costs of these managers, or are you just focusing on net returns?
No, we definitely look at fees also. I mean, it's you know, it's people, process, price, performance. Four P's. There might even be a fifth one. I don't know. But so price, you know, let's say if one manager is, let's say the average large cap value fund might be 75 basis points. Well, if one manager's 35 and another one's 45, then I'm not going to worry about the price. They both give you very good prices. But there might be another one that have very good performance, but maybe it's there's one fund I was just looking at last night, and it was like 115, over 1%. I don't care how good their numbers were. If you're that much more expensive, somewhere along the way, that's going to drag down your performance. Maybe you had a great year, a great 3 years. But I'm not, you know, nobody's that much better than all the really good managers. So it's part of the equation. And on performance, it's not just how did they do over 5 years, how did they do over 3 years. It's how did they do what they did, how they do in down markets, how they do in up markets. And I say, especially, you know, recognizing yourselves, you want to be a little bit more protective in the down markets. So if we can get you up to 60% equities, but then have a little bit more conservative equity managers, it allows you to get to 60 and be more comfortable with that.
Your numbers on page 10 are all net of fees, I presume, right? The returns are net of the fund fees anyway.
I think those on that page are gross. Pretty sure those are gross. It's a whole new system, and I'm still checking those things out.
Yeah, the footnote in the bottom left.
Gross. There you go.
Oh,
so I was right. Yeah. And the reason why we do gross on that is because we're comparing them to the benchmark. And the benchmark, you know, is a gross rate of return. So when we look at universe comparisons, let's go. Let me just show you one example. Let's go to all the way to global equities. So I'll pick one that did really well last quarter. Okay. Dodge and Cox. Okay. If you go all the way to page 35. I don't know about yours. Mine set as a 35 on top of a 20, but it's 35. Okay. That's the universe of comparing Dodge and Cox against other global managers. Okay, everybody on that? It's like the floating bar chart. Okay. In that one, we're showing net rate of returns, because that was showing them against a universe of other mutual funds. So you might say, why the two difference? The first number is comparing it against the benchmark. This is comparing to net rates of returns of other mutual funds. In this case, you can see it was 13.8% and ranked in the 38th percentile. Now, observationally, Dodge & Cox is the kind of manager that does really well in the up markets and does pretty poorly in the down markets. I said, Michael, why would you have them in a portfolio? Well, you have the other manager. You have Washington. You know, you have something in a large cap value. It's defensive. You don't want to. I like my sports analogies. You don't want just all singles hitters. You got to have a couple that, when the things are going really well, are doing really well. Otherwise, everything will be just too defensive. So it's blending the two together. And we, for those of you who are so inclined, we break out for you, how much they have in each country, what their allocation is in each country. And we have some people in our organization that love to look at that and others that do not. So.
I like the sector information.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Page 37. Yeah.
38.
37, 38, yeah. Yeah, so 38 shows you. 38 is what you call attribution. It says, okay, they outperformed their benchmark. What was it? Was it because they did a better job picking which sectors they were in? Did they do a better job in the stocks they were in? Did they do a better job, in this case, in the countries they're in? Did they do a better job because of the currency weighting? So it really helps peel apart that effect, you know.
It's the turnover ratio on average on Dodge and Cox. I was wondering, get all these different countries they're working with, and of course they all have different fortunes.
Yeah.
I don't know if they do they stick with them.
Yeah, Dodge and Cox is what you call a deep value manager, and they tend to buy and hold. In fact, that's one of the reasons why they will outperform and underperform by quite a bit at times, because they'll be into the markets real early, almost like, for those who might remember Templeton, they might get in 2 years and have to wait. Sometimes it's painful waiting until everybody else finally sees a value in something. Okay, so they're long-term holders. Harding Loevner, they're not, as a growth manager, growth managers tend to be a little bit more turnover approach. So still not, you know, I don't know off the top of my head, but maybe about 50% a year, which is not, you know, that's sort of more the norm, you know.
Yeah. Any other questions for Michael? Performance report. So
are we chart? Is that what the committee would like us to do?
Our goal, I believe it was, or, you know, part of our goal was to look at that structure of the OPEB equities and see what we could do to make it a little bit better.
Yeah. Michael's going to make recommendations next time for that we'll consider.
I'm going to bring you a couple choices for consideration.
Right.
There will not be a specific recommendation, but we'll bring you three to look at in a large cap value. And probably we might go out on a limb and make a recommendation on the index side. And then we will bring you some recommendations to how to rebalance the portfolio. So if you're going to make these changes, here's how much we would suggest you put in each one of these, you know.
Good idea. That was part of the next agenda item. The goals for this year is to take a hard look at that fund.
I'm glad we have more flexibility now with our investments. Mm-hmm. We don't just have to respond to you, responds to us. I think it's going to pay off in the long run for us.
Thank you for doing it.
Thank you.
And then we will. I wasn't sure on the investment policy statement for the pension. You'd like us to do a review of that?
Yeah, I mean, 5 years is probably a good idea, as we see everything so volatile. Nothing stays the same after 5 years. And
sure. If
we want to open that fixed income up, that's a good time to talk about it, and we can decide, you know, yes or no at that time. But it does bear worth looking at. So.
So I'm not necessarily volunteering for work, but I think I would suggest it is time. It's been 5 years, so.
Well, you recommend changing our investment percentages? You did bring it up. We're 60-40 equities, bonds. Just, you know, keep in the back of your mind.
Unless the board seems inclined to do something different than that, we would leave that at that number. I think what I want to stress was the recognition that with that kind of mix and the amount, and that you have to have some cash, even with the new approach, that, you know, you need to consider looking at the actuarial assumptions. That, you know, what I've observed is that the county seems to be comfortable at 60-40. That you may not be comfortable. I could sit here and say, yeah, drive down the road a little bit faster, and you might say, oh, we don't want to go down the road faster. Okay, well then let's. I like that analogy, but it's then let's leave a little bit earlier, give a little bit more time to get there then, and that would be changing the actual assumption.
Well, we could stay maybe 60-40, but look at the fixed and do a little bit of broadening there rather than a whole bunch of, you know, start small and.
Yeah.
All right. Any questions? So our next meeting is, do you know, Nancy? I know it's August. I'm sorry, I don't have that date in front of me.
August 2nd.
Okay. We'll send, if anything is prepared for that meeting, we'll send it out ahead of time and a reminder with the agenda. Thank you for coming, everyone, today.
Thank you.
And meeting adjourned at 11:35.